Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the Director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Postwar Reconstruction Fiasco. He's also on the adjunct faculty at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative and has worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And I take it that you organized a conference recently in Paris that essentially brought together the Kurdish Institute of Paris and your institute at Columbia University and members of the Syrian opposition to dialogue on power sharing in Syria after the fall of Assad. There are reports already, David Phillips, of fighting between the rebel Farouk brigades, which are among the most effective of the secular organizations, where one of the leaders, Abu Azam, was shot by the Islamist al-Nusra people. And apparently there's more and more of these incidents. So already you have, albeit at a smaller scale, you have the Syrian opposition shooting at each other. So give us a sense of the disconnect, which appears to be between the people in the field and the people who meet. Is there a real disconnect there between the political spokespersons and the actual operational people?
Our meeting in Paris involved minority groups, and the participants were largely Kurds from Syria. Of the 30 or so who gathered, more than half came from the Qamishli area within Syria. And it was really the first time that the Kurds from within Syria had gotten together and had a dialogue with diaspora Kurds. I think that the way to avoid this kind of violent conflict between different constituencies in the opposition is to get them talking to each other about what kinds of power-sharing arrangements they're going to want to have in place after Assad. If there's a political dialogue going on, they're less likely to use violence to settle their differences.
Well, of course, at the Arab League summit underway in Doha, the Syrian opposition was seated as the official representatives of Syria, which, of course, has angered the Assad regime. And the rebel leader who quit the other day, Mr. Hatib, has joined with the National Coalition's vice presidents, George Sabra and Suhir Atassi, and the recently elected Prime Minister, Hassan Hito. So to that extent, there seems to be some, at least, a political group. What do the Kurds have to do with this group that's seated in Doha at the Arab League summit in the name of Syria?
So there are two important points here. The first is that you have to rely on partners on the ground in country. The mistake that we made in Iraq was listening to the diaspora and investing too much expectation in them. So if there's going to be any kind of a fluid regime change after Assad, it's going to be driven by the in-country actors, and we have to reach out to them, get to know them, and help them in dialogue with each other. So that's an important point. The other is the role of the Kurds. About 15% of Syria's population is Kurdish. They have really yet to be counted in the revolution. Over the years, they've been afflicted by the Assad regime. They've had their identity and their rights denied. They're also very deeply worried about Islamists and Sunni Arabs that are leading the revolution. So they've been sitting on the fence, waiting to see which way the wind is going to blow. They know that there's going to be a regime change. So they're starting to have a political dialogue with each other. They're also beginning to reach out to other members of the Syrian National Council so they can forge coalitions. Our role is to be helpful and to try to create an environment where they can focus on technical, legal, and constitutional issues about how they'll govern themselves.
Again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peacebuilding and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's also on the adjunct faculty at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative, and he's worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. So the takeaway from President Obama's recent trip to Israel and Jordan and the West Bank was largely that he arranged a phone call that brought together or brought back together the Prime Minister of Israel and the Prime Minister of Turkey. Of course, there's been a bitter estrangement between those two countries, and I don't know the extent to which they're healed. But it would indicate to me that something's going on the ground there. In fact, Netanyahu said it has a lot to do with Syria. So what's your understanding of what the Turks and the Israelis are trying to get together over vis-a-vis Syria?
Nobody wants chemical weapons to fall into the hands of terrorist organizations. I suspect that the reason why Prime Minister Erdogan and Prime Minister Netanyahu decided to have their phone conversation now is because they both share a national interest. Israel doesn't want Syria's WMD ending up with Hezbollah, its avowed enemy with whom it has recently waged a war and which is a foreign terrorist organization. And likewise, Turkey doesn't want the WMD ending up in the hands of the PKK, with whom it has fought a civil war over the past four decades. So Israel and Turkey have come together out of a common concern that Syria risks imploding. And when it falls apart, its chemical weapons are going to fall into the wrong hands.
So what is the role then of the PKK leader, Öcalan, who's in custody, been in custody for some time, calling for a ceasefire between the PKK and the Turkish military?
It's rather remarkable that Abdullah Öcalan, who's been in custody for more than a decade, is still running the PKK from his cell in Imrali prison. Through his lawyers, he issues instructions, and he is still the head honcho behind the organization. Turkey's military intelligence has been meeting discreetly with Öcalan to talk about a ceasefire and the terms for a negotiation around a comprehensive peace going forward. The fact that Öcalan has called for the PKK to withdraw its fighters from Turkish territory and that Prime Minister Erdogan has renewed his commitment to protecting and promoting the identity of Kurds in Turkey is a very good step. But it's part of a process, and there have been ceasefires before. Ultimately, if there's going to be a peace agreement between the PKK and Turkey, it's going to have to go beyond democracy and development. It's going to have to address the really thorny issues of how do you create an amnesty for these hardened PKK fighters, and what kind of accountability is going to exist, both for members of the security services in Turkey who have committed crimes, but also for the PKK, which itself has victimized Turks over these years.
So back to the central question, David Phillips, about the connection or the disconnection between the Free Syrian Army and the various factions fighting to topple the Assad dictatorship and the political leadership, the heads of which are seated at the Arab summit in Doha representing Syria. And if you have, as I mentioned at the outset, already incidents of where a rebel commander of a secular group, the Farouk Brigades, Abu Azam, was shot by the Islamist group al-Nusra, and apparently there have been a number of showdowns between the Islamists and the more secular rebels, that's certainly not a harbinger for things to come. On the other hand, one hears that shipments of arms from Qatar are increasing, and also that the CIA is getting more and more active in training and selecting groups with whom they feel comfortable giving weapons to. So what's happening on the ground? Because for the longest time, the Iranians have had their act together, and they've been doubling down, being absolutely unflinching in their support for Assad. But the West has clearly vacillated. Has that changed?
My most recent book, which is entitled Liberating Kosovo, is a study of interventions over the past decade. And there's one salient lesson that emerges from all these experiences. Reaching the tipping point and toppling a regime is an event that occurs on a single day, but building an effective state and designing effective governance is a process that takes a much longer period of time and a sustained commitment from the U.S. and the international community. And that never works unless you have a reliable and credible local partner who's trusted by constituents on the ground. So there are two parts to your question, Ian. One is the military assistance that's going to the Free Syrian Army, and the other is what comes after Assad in the event that the Free Syrian Army succeeds. Part of the reason why we've been reluctant to arm the Free Syrian Army is because we don't know very much about them, and there isn't a cohesive leadership structure in place to replace Assad when he goes. That's why having a political dialogue about governance is just as important during this stage of a conflict as arming rebel groups. You can topple the regime in a day, but you can't establish effective governance unless you're in it for the long haul.
So who's working on the that portfolio, if that's the right way to describe it? Who's working on forging a real connection between the political leadership that's representing Syria now at Doha and the fighters? Because Assad's just retook an important neighborhood in Homs from the rebels. So it's certainly premature to write off Assad's military. So how is that achieved then?
Ultimately, it has to be achieved by Syrians themselves. Outsiders can play a catalytic role, but Syrians have to get together and they've got to figure out how they're going to interact in the future. The kinds of meetings that occur internationally create a safe space for them to start talking about how they're going to rule the country if and when they come to power. At our meeting in Paris, we had the special envoy from the United States, the special envoy of France, of Norway. We had President Hollande's senior foreign policy advisor. So there are some countries that are really leaning forward on this, working on a political solution. There are other countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar that are much more focused on providing military support to the Free Syrian Army. What's important is to be able to map who the players are, know who you're dealing with, and try to develop a relationship with them and help them develop a relationship with one another. Otherwise, there's bound to be spoilers and infighting, and then the conflict risks escalating, and you might actually find yourself with a worse problem in the future than exists now. And what exists now is pretty horrible.
Well, apparently one of the motives behind Ahmed Moaz al-Hatib, the rebel leader who quit and now has rejoined the opposition and is seated representing Syria at the Arab summit in Doha, he was upset about a lot of things, but he was also upset about the role of Saudi Arabia and Qatar in supplying arms to the Salafists. So is there a problem here about which of the sponsors of the Syrian opposition, what outcomes they want? Is there a divide between what the U.S. and France, for example, and Turkey want and what Saudi Arabia and Qatar want? Do they want regimes like they have, particularly the Saudis, a theocratic regime, an Islamic regime, or is that where the fundamental problem lies?
And the fundamental problem lies with Assad, who's a butcher and a war criminal. Getting these groups together is difficult in and of itself, especially because they are proxies for regional powers. I mean, what's missing in the diplomacy is a contact group that should be based in Turkey and brings different countries together so they can have a coherent strategy about how they're going to support the rebels and how they're going to work with the political side of the opposition to stand up some kind of a credible alternative. It's not rocket science. Ultimately, Syria should be democratic, pluralistic, and federal. There should be decentralization that pushes power from Damascus to the region so that the minorities, including the Kurds, have their interests upheld. getting from here to there is extremely difficult when a population is under duress. And with almost 100,000 people killed and several million displaced, there's been an enormous duress for the people of Syria. And it is true, Al-Khatib is correct, that the international community has not done enough to support them diplomatically, in humanitarian terms. Since he's seeking military assistance, you know, his view is they require more military assistance and training. I'm sure that the U.S. can provide some logistical support, some equipment, some hard-shell vehicles, some night vision goggles, some transportation infrastructure that would be of enormous use. So there's a big malaise among the opposition because they're getting killed every day. You know, we're talking a good game, but we're not delivering on it.
Well, at the conference in Paris that you organized, David Phillips, with the Kurdish groups and the Syrian opposition, you mentioned some of the very distinguished people that spoke there, including Robert Ford, the U.S. ambassador to Syria, who I imagine is in pretty close contact with the new Secretary of State, John Kerry, isn't he? So when you suggest that what's needed is a contact group so that the foreign sponsors of the opposition in Syria can coordinate, has that been suggested to Kerry?
So you'll have to invite Ambassador Ford on your program and ask him.
Right, but it's just assumption on my part.
He's a skillful diplomat. He's working this problem 24/7. Informally, there's a lot of international coordination, but a contact group creates an institution, as it did in Kosovo, to marginalize those countries that are acting as spoilers. I mean, just as Russia tried to block NATO and U.S.-led action in Kosovo, Russia is blocking international efforts here in Syria. So one way to marginalize the Russians is to create an institution that gives greater voice to other stakeholders. So, you know, there are ways of solving these problems. I'm sure the U.S. is working all those strategies very hard, but clearly, you know, we haven't done enough to stop the bloodshed. When we get to a tipping point, we better be ready to work with a broad coalition of Syrians because it's going to be chaotic no matter what.
Well, just in closing, David Phillips, what kind of timeline are we talking about here? Does anybody have any idea? Because the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, has on a number of occasions indicated that Assad was about to fall, and that clearly has not happened. So, as we mentioned earlier, it does seem that there's an uptick in the supplying of arms to the Syrian rebels, but there's also Iran is unflinching in its support of the Assads, and John Kerry got nowhere with the Iraqis trying to convince them they shouldn't allow the overflight of all this equipment that's going into Syria. So what's your sense of a timeline here, given that there have been some premature statements about the fall of Assad?
So the Syrian armed forces are extremely capable. They are receiving from Iran resupplies on a daily basis. And those transport planes are flying through Iraqi airspace, and even though we've asked Iraq to crack down, they refuse to do so. So this war could be a long grind that can go on for a long period of time. But at the same token, Ian, you can't really foresee a tipping point. Now, for all the intelligence that you gather and the analysis that people do, you can get to that moment when the regime falls very quickly if some of the key regime allies, particularly in the military, feel that their interest is better served by switching sides. So we could be looking at a war in Syria over the next year or more, or we could open the paper tomorrow and see that there's a tipping point and a dramatic change. It's going to require concerted diplomatic activity led by the U.S. to prepare for either of those eventualities. That's why the kind of meeting we had in Paris, looking at constitutional arrangements for the next phase, are such an important part of planning for the future.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I mean, speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's also on the adjunct faculty at Harvard's Humanitarian Initiative and was a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. His latest book is Liberating Kosovo. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. Bye for now. An angel song about the home of the brave and the land you run the free one time.